WMAI.org on the web. You know, and we've been seeing a lot of news coverage here in New York City of ongoing tensions between police unions, particularly the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association President Pat Lynch and Mayor de Blasio. The PBA has been highly critical of the mayor's stance on police tactics and his support for protests over police brutality. What about a related but less talked about occupation, private security officers? Private security is one of the fastest growing occupations in the U.S. There are approximately 1.1 million private security officers working in the United States, far outnumbering police officers. Despite the size of the industry, most security officers are paid poverty wages, have few benefits, and receive minimal training. The average pay for security officers is less than $23,000 a year, according to the Service Employees International Union. Joining us to talk about global unionization movements in the private security sector and others, we have Jamie McCollum, assistant professor of sociology at Middlebury College and the author of Global Unions, Local Power, The New Spirit of Transnational Labor Organizing, which came out last year and won the prestigious Best Book Award from the American Sociological Association. We also have with us Nick Rudikoff, Global Affairs Coordinator for the labor organization Warehouse Workers United and a consultant with various unions and worker centers, helping them to develop strategies for global campaigns. Good morning to you both. Good morning, Jamie, and good morning, Nick. Thank you for joining Pam and myself this morning on the morning show here.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thanks.
Let's start with you, first of all, Jamie. Your book about a campaign to organize security guards globally. What interested you in this campaign?
Well, I became interested in campaigns to organize janitors, actually, before that. And this campaign was sort of a spin-off of that campaign in the United States. The campaigns were rather successful early on, and then they hit a stopping point, and the unions had a decision to make, either to sort of give up or scale up, in a sense. And the global fight to organize against one company in particular, called G4S, which is the third largest private employer in the world today, caught my attention in that it was rather successful, aggressive, exciting, and demonstrated a whole slew of new strategies that labor had been experimenting with for a while that seemed to be catching on and working, not only in the United States, but also in places where, you know, we typically don't hear about union organizing drives in America. And so the relationship between those global places and the United States, working classes ended up sort of catching my attention.
Mm-hmm. And what is the difference between police and private security unions? I think I'd like to have you speak to that for our listeners so we can understand this.
Well, I mean, sometimes police and private security guards do similar jobs, but very often they don't. You know, a lot of private guards don't carry weapons, for one thing. They're not public employees, obviously. It's a black-dominated industry. It's not, you know, sometimes people say being a cop is a pathway into the middle class, and being a private security guard is not really. The unions that they work with are inordinately far more oriented towards something like social justice or fairness or like a social project. I mean, the security guards' campaigns in America were, to some extent, part and parcel of larger anti-racist campaigns in the wake of 9/11. I think there's been ample evidence that the PBA is uninterested in anything like that. So they're in some ways, on the surface, they seem perhaps similar, but in reality, they're pretty far apart.
Very interesting. Wow. And Nick, how does this resonate with your work on global unions? What's the difference? What's different strategically when workers organize globally as opposed to at the local or national level?
Well, I think, you know, we're living in unfortunately in an era where corporations are dominating global economies and global politics in an unprecedented and awful way. We tend to, you know, here in the United States, we think a lot about the exploitation of the workers that we see every day and the struggles we read about in our local papers. But, of course, they're connected to the struggles of workers all around the world. And, you know, unions are under attack, the working class under attack all over the world. So it's increasingly important, I think, that unions and workers' movements around the world cooperate across national borders, because ultimately it's a small group of corporations that are responsible for the conditions that workers are facing. Security guards are a good example of that. As security guards, you know, security guard companies are quite large, as Jamie just mentioned, but they work for even larger companies, right? I mean, they're hired by banks, they're hired by real estate owners, they're hired by restaurant companies or retailers. And those companies, in a lot of ways, set the terms and conditions under which the workers work, not the subcontractor. So in a typical global supply chain scenario, you have workers in a garment factory, say, in Cambodia, working for a local factory which is owned by, let's say, Korean capital, doing work for a New York-based fashion house, who is in turn hired by Walmart to produce a T-shirt at insanely low prices. So that complex web of corporate relationships is actually quite simple. Walmart is dictating the terms and conditions, if not legally, then practically, economically, that workers in Cambodia are facing. So if the workers in Cambodia want to pick a fight with the Korean company that owns their factory, that's fine, but I would argue it would be more prudent for them to target Walmart, because Walmart is really the one that wields economic power.
And so what are some of the ways that they could actually target Walmart, for example, from what at least, from a lay perspective is afar?
I think, you know, in today's media environment, you have, you know, these big brand names like Walmart or McDonald's, others carry a lot of weight. So just workers in a foreign country calling out a transnational corporation has some impact. But then there's these alliances, these solidarity alliances that exist around the world, groups like United Students Against Sweatshops, Labor Behind the Label in Europe, who are committed to, you know, engaging in solidarity on behalf of workers in the global south who produce most of the goods that we use here in the global north. So I think that there's opportunities for campaigning, there's opportunities for action, there's opportunities for collaboration, say, between Walmart retail workers, Walmart warehouse workers, and Cambodian garment workers. They all really have the same enemy.
Interesting. And so this sort of complicates this idea that that globalization really undermines worker power. Jamie, what would you say to that? Do you argue that in some cases it might enhance their power?
Well, the scenario that Nick is describing is exactly the one facing workers everywhere. I mean, it's increasingly the case that if you're a low-level service worker in America, your employer is a European company, for example. And so the fight you pick invariably ends up being pretty far from your workplace. And so you get it. So from what you said, it's kind of like there has been this typical scenario, this typical understanding of which economic globalization undermines worker power. In some ways, it also brings them into the same fight. Different workers in the same multinational firm, in some ways, are encouraged to take a sort of a concerted approach to their company. Mm. But that's not really enough, you know? I mean, there's not just enough built-in power to that to do it. Unions really have had to figure out ways to take advantage of that situation. And campaigns like ones Nick is working on and others are some of the pioneers in this, trying to experiment with ways to, you know, literally build a movement, not just assume that there is a movement because these companies exist the way they do. And so we're seeing new kinds of, in the 90s, they used to call them codes of conduct, different ways of bringing corporations into some sort of union sphere of influence. Today, we see these things called global framework agreements, which are these large kind of like contracts that dictate the terms and conditions under which certain multinational companies can operate. And so unions are finding ways to force companies to submit to these kinds of codes.
Interesting. Well, we're almost out of time, but I have one last question for you. Perhaps each of you can answer. We know that union rates, membership rates are declining. Do you think that organizing globally will have any impact on workers' desire and ability to join unions?
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, it's becoming increasingly clear to a lot of U.S. unions that organizing in one country against a corporation that's based in 20 countries is a losing proposition, and that people are going to have to come together in some sort of cross-border alliance to make a difference anywhere. In some ways, it's sort of like, you know, instead of act local, think global, it's the opposite. It's kind of like act global, think local. Mm. And I think that's becoming increasingly, you know, a point of interest among the U.S. labor movement.
We've had on the line with us Jamie McCullum, assistant professor of sociology at Middlebury College and the author of Global Unions, Local Power, The New Spirit of Transnational Labor Organizing. And that came out last year, winning the Best Book Award from the American Sociological Association. Also, Nick Rudikoff, Global Affairs Coordinator for the labor organization Warehouse Workers United, and consulting with unions and workers' centers. Thank you so much to you both for joining us on the broadcast this morning.
Thanks.
Thank you.